and a very warm welcome back to the second in the series of podcasts brought to you by the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group. My name's Julie Jones and I'm going to be your host today. So it's with great pleasure that I have Dr. Carl Counsell with me today, who's kindly agreed to give up some of his valuable time to talk about his current research in the field of neurology. Dr. Counsell is a consultant neurologist working within NHS Grampian, and he also holds a clinical leadership with the University of Aberdeen. Carl, as many of you will know, is also the joint lead of the North of Scotland Parkinson's Excellence Network. So an altogether very busy chap, dividing his time between clinical work and research. So as with the prior podcast, the today's questions have been compiled by the Parkinson's community based up here in the north of Scotland. So today the focus of what we're going to hear from Dr. Counsell is about his research and its impact on clinical practice locally and nationally, and what he feels about some of the challenges of undertaking research within the Parkinson's community. Okay, thank you very much, Carl, for agreeing to ask these questions. So we're just going to get started from the top of this list that I have. So maybe you could start by telling us about your research and how and why you ended up looking at Parkinson's and your specific interest that you have.
So thanks, Julie. So I actually had research training in stroke. So I was trained in Edinburgh. And what that research training did for me was gave me an incredibly good grounding in what I would call clinical epidemiological techniques. So things around evidence-based medicine, things about observational studies, which are was a really good grounding and did some research in stroke. But I knew then, because there are lots of good stroke research units doing that sort of research, that that wasn't for me. So what I wanted to do was to extend those methods, if you like, into areas of neurological disease, which were essentially under-researched in that way, where I thought that I could actually contribute. And because of a variety of factors, not least going to Australia for 18 months to do some movement disorder training, I thought that Parkinson's was, you know, both a fascinating area, but also an area that needed sensible, if you like, new clinical epidemiologically driven research. So there's lots of science, genetics, lab-based research, but there wasn't at that stage a real track record of good observational studies in Parkinson's. So that was really what led me into Parkinson's. And when I came to Aberdeen, so when I was a consultant, made a consultant in 2001, I knew that that was an opportunity to do a long-term study, observational study of Parkinson's and associated Parkinson's conditions, to look at how people do over time in real life. And so that's what we did. So that's what we set up from 2002, was a study to identify everyone with Parkinson's that was newly diagnosed or Parkinsonism in Aberdeen and surrounding areas, and then to put them into a follow-up study where we saw them at least yearly and watched them over the course of the disease to see how things changed over time. And so it wasn't an interventional study at that stage. There were no trial treatments, although some patients did go into other trials that were going on. So there was a trial called PD-Med, and we recruited some patients into that. But the primary aim was this observational study to look at how people fared from the moment of diagnosis through to end of life. And that study's continued to be the basis of most of the research that I do. And we still have some patients who are alive and being followed up in that study, along with their carers and along with a control group, because you obviously want to see how people with the condition fare against people who don't have the condition. And so we have a control group who are closely matched, who are followed up at the same time. So that's a little bit of the background.
Okay, so in relation to the PINE study, which you were just talking about, what was there anything that threw up that surprised you or you hadn't been expecting in terms of looking at people over a decade?
I have to say I wasn't surprised, but maybe other people have been. So the key thing that sort of study does, so just if we take a step back, most of the previous sort of research around the incidence of how common Parkinson's is, and how people fare over time was based on groups of patients that were often quite highly selected from often research active centres run by neurologists who often see a selected group of people with Parkinson's, so often people who are relatively young onset, for example. And so when I was trained in neurology as a medical student in the late 1980s, I remember being told the mean survival for Parkinson's was 20-odd years. And that didn't fit with what I'd seen in clinical practice when I'd seen people of all ages of Parkinson's. And things that, you know, Parkinson's rarely caused cognitive problems. And again, at that stage, we were sort of fixed on the motor features. So, the important things that we, and not just we, but others who've done similar things to us have demonstrated is... This is clearly a condition of the elderly. So that's not to say that there aren't young people who get it, which is clearly the case. But if you look at people under age of 40, the number of new cases coming into the population, so newly diagnosed patients, it's 0.2% are under the age of 40. They live longer, and therefore young onset cases will tend to be overrepresented in clinics because they're living longer, but the actual number of new cases coming into a population is tiny. So the mean, the average age of onset of Parkinson's at diagnosis is 70 plus years. The peak is in the 70 to 80 age group. So this is really a condition that is predominantly, and geriatricians, medicine for the elderly, would have known this for a long time. You know, it's predominantly a condition that you see as people get older, and that's obviously an issue as we age as a population. And needless to say, when you start looking at all patients with Parkinson's, they don't survive an average of 22 years. They survive an average of 7 years, and that's because you're looking at the whole population rather than the younger onset group, who will survive a lot longer. And we've demonstrated, you know, through observational, just watching those patients, that there is a very high, risk of cognitive failure. There's a high risk of balance problems and falls. So the rough figure I tend to use off the top of my head is, for most issues in Parkinson's, it's about 5% per year. 5% per year fracture, have a significant fracture, often from early on in the condition. 5% per year will have a cognitive problem and have major cognitive issues. This is a condition that, you know, has a major impact. And people with Parkinson's will not have to tell you that. It has a major impact on lives, not least, their quality of life, but also their physical ability to do things and their duration of life.
So in regard to that, it just shows the diversity of how Parkinson's affects everybody, and different people have a different journey as they learn to live with their Parkinson's. I suppose moving away from the PINE study, what in your opinion do you think is the most exciting piece of research or areas of research currently being undertaken either in your own field or, you know, nationally or globally?
There are two things that I would probably highlight. So one relates to this issue of how people fare over time, because, again, you know, when you're dealing with large groups of patients, you often get average results, and that's what you tend to report. But within that average result, there's a huge diversity, as you said, of how people do. So that's what we call heterogeneity. So these very marked differences in two people who look very similar at diagnosis can have very dramatically different prognosis or outcomes as you follow them up. And what's unclear is why that should be. So one of the things that we and others are doing are trying to identify what are the factors that early on, and then as the disease progresses, you can use to identify people who are going to do relatively well regarding certain aspects of Parkinson's and people who are going to do not so well. And that's what we call prognostic modelling or predictive modelling. And it's hard because you will never be able to predict with certainty in an individual. What you're going to be always trying to do is to group people with certain traits and say, yep, this is your risk of developing X, Y or Z as the condition goes on, and at these sorts of time points in the condition. So that's really in its relative infancy. It's hard because, as I said, there's a lot of stuff you can't predict. You can't predict if someone is going to develop a major non-Parkinson's illness that will affect their prognosis. So if they, for instance, had a sudden heart attack or developed cancer, so that's very difficult. But there are certain factors within Parkinson's itself, both genetic and non-genetic factors, that you may be able to use to identify people who are at high risk of certain problems with their Parkinson's over time. And that may allow you to, one, target certain treatments to those groups, but it also just allows you to be on the lookout for, these people are at high risk of certain problems, and therefore you can be on the lookout for that and put things in place, hopefully, that will help manage those issues. So that's one aspect. The second aspect, which I'm sure everyone is desperate for, is better treatments, so we've got pretty good treatments for the motor conditions, which haven't really changed over the last 50 years now, 40 years certainly. And that's probably partly because, levodopa is so good. But what we need are treatments that slow the progression, and not just slow the progression a little, but hopefully have a significant effect on slowing the progression. And those are treatments that therefore need to prolong nerve survival, so neuroprotective drugs. And so far, as I'm sure most people are aware, we've been really unsuccessful at generating that. And that's I think lots of people provide lots of reasons for why that might be, including design of studies and, you've picked the wrong patients to put into the trials. I think it's a bit simpler than that. I think it's because it's such a complex disease. I think it is, it is a really complex disease with lots of things going on, and therefore it's difficult to target things that protect nerve cells. But one of the things that is going on at the moment is a group led by a team in London and Plymouth, but involving lots of satellite centres, and is trying to develop an ongoing trial, what they call a multi-arm, multi-stage trial, a MAMS trial, whereby you have a protocol into which you can fit new drugs as they come along, some of which will be repurposed drugs, in other words, drugs that have been used for other things but have got evidence to suggest they might improve or improve nerve survival in Parkinson's. And you fit those drugs in to a study. You follow people up for 3 years or a amount of time, not too long, and you look and see if there's a signal that these are having an effect. And if there is, they carry on, and they might do a bigger study looking at slightly more important outcomes to look at that. If it's got no signal of effect, it drops out and is replaced by another drug. And the advantage of that is you're not reinventing the clinical trial wheel all the time. And so that's really quite an exciting thing that's going on at the moment. It's going to take a little bit of while to get going, but not forever. So there's a plan to get that going within the next 2 or 3 years, and it will open the opportunity to in the way that they've done in hematology for years, for instance, in certain lymphomas and leukemias, to put in new treatments and to be assessing all the time whether these drugs are adding anything. Because I think what's clear is there isn't going to be a single drug that sorts out Parkinson's, even from in terms of a protective neuroprotective effect. It's going to be little incremental benefits that will then add up to something more. And you're going to probably need a little cocktail of medications, but you're not going to find that out until you start looking at individual ones. And if they find a drug that works, what would happen in the trial is that trial becomes part of standard care. So it gets added into the protocol that everyone gets it. And so you've got the first step on an incremental step to trying to improve treatment. So that's really quite exciting, but it's a lot of hard work. And it's technically quite difficult to do, but people are making significant progress.
It's fantastic to hear the amount of energy that's going into the research. But definitely, what's clear from you is the complexity of the condition and the heterogeneity, as you said, amongst within people, between groups, is something that makes the research particularly challenging. So the research isn't going to answer these questions certainly overnight. I think something that's been really interesting with COVID over the last few years that's been with us, it has managed to speed up the research journey in relation to those COVID studies. How do you think we can start to implement research quicker within the Parkinson's community so that we can make a difference to people sooner? What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So for those of us who are in the research arena, it's become increasingly frustrating about the bureaucracy that you have to go through to get studies up and running, a lot of which is driven by well-intentioned people, but a lot of which is just distinctly unhelpful and starts from a premise that researchers are out to do harm, not good. So we're not trusted, essentially, and therefore you have to fill in all these forms to say we're not going to do this, that, and next thing with the data and so on. So research bureaucracy has escalated enormously in my 20 years in research, to the extent that it actually puts me off doing some studies because I just don't have the time to trawl through that. So what was interesting in COVID is a lot of that was streamlined. And so I don't know, and it wouldn't surprise me if it doesn't get extended into other studies now that COVID is no longer a major issue. But there certainly could be lessons to be learned in terms of streamlining the bureaucracy and simplifying it, and actually coming back to a point of trust where, you know, researchers are, obviously there's an element of research where people are out to blow their own trumpets and out for personal gain in the sense that they get the glory of the research results. So there are incentives for people, you know, to do things that aren't right. But that's not, I've never come across that, to be honest, in my research career. Most people are doing it because they want to help. And I think we need to get back to that and make studies much simpler. And I think data protection has been an absolute pain in the neck. And again, I wouldn't want to say you don't need any data protection, but the level of data protection that we've got at the moment is just silly. So I think there are lots of things. Those things are all beyond researchers. Those all things have to be happening at senior government, NHS, ethics level. And that's difficult because, you know, these committees have been designed to generate protocols and that's their job and they want to do it well. And so they tick all the cross all the T's and dot all the I's. And without actually knowing, it's making research really hard to do. So I think there has to be a review of all of that, to be honest. The other thing I think that will help is not to reinvent the wheel. So that's the advantage of this, for instance, the MAMS trial, is if you've got a protocol that can be rolled forward, then you just have to go through the process once and then you can just add new treatments in. And so I think that will be helpful in streamlining certainly the neuroprotective trials. And I know there's a similar study where they're in the States, which they're looking to set up to try and identify ways of perhaps prevent, much more ambitious ways of trying to prevent people who are at high risk of Parkinson's developing Parkinson's. But again, that might be a rolling study that you can add new agents into. That's a whole different level of complexity because, for a lot of reasons that we probably don't have time to discuss. So research needs to keep going. It needs to find solutions to some of the barriers that have been put in place. It needs to be simplified. But the main drive for research is always going to be that people want to do it because they're interested. And that usually, if you've got time, which is an increasing problem, just drives you to overcome some of these barriers.
So just when you touched on that, what do you think are the main barriers to get people involved in Parkinson's research?
There's two. So on the research side, it's bureaucracy and full stop. On the volunteer side, I think there is issues around, again, the way how complex that we've made this. So in trying to generate informed consent, which is clearly critical, you want people to be informed about their doing, I think we've gone to overkill. So when you have a patient information sheet that runs to 10 pages, I wouldn't read that. And I'm an academic. I would just go, well, crikey, life's too short. So I think, again, we've got to simplify information that we give to patients. I think we've got to make it easier for them to do it. I think we've got to make consent easier. And that is happening. So you can do that now, you know, not just by having to write and sign a form. It can be done increasingly by remotely. And I think, again, that depends on trust, you know. So the idea that patients are going to take part in research willingly without being forced should be the starting point, not that people are going to coerce people into doing research. So I think there are a number of issues where it can be helped. But again, I think that there is largely a problem of bureaucracy. Patients clearly need to be informed and aware of what's going on and know what's available for them to take part in. And that's quite difficult because you've got potentially hundreds of studies and they're not all suitable for any one individual. And so keeping track of all of that is quite hard as well.
Okay, thank you for that. So you've mentioned, you touched briefly on the PD Med study and you've obviously mentioned the PINE study. What do you think the impact at a clinical level some of your research has had so far?
That's a good question. And obviously it's what we're striving for is for impact. I don't, certainly from a PINE study point of view, I don't think we've dramatically changed how patients are managed. But I think we've got better understanding of the condition and of the prognosis. And I think that is in itself is helpful. I mean, in terms of some of these other studies like PD-Med, I mean, PD-Med was quite a large, for Parkinson's disease, it was a large trial, although actually in the global picture, it wasn't that big a trial. But that certainly helped establish that, you know, levodopa, so Madopar or Sinemet, was the best treatment. And there'd been for a while a feeling that it was old hat and it was because it was old, it wasn't as good as the newer treatments. And that was clearly found to be not the case. And it's helped establish that, you know, in later disease as well, that there's not much to differentiate some of the additional add-on treatments that we use as well as levodopa. So I think that's been helpful because it's actually made life a bit simpler for clinicians. And you've got this whole spectrum of drugs that we've got available, but we've got a clear idea of what the first choices should be. So that's been helpful.
So, thinking about here in the northeast of Scotland, is there any opportunities for people from the Parkinson's community to get involved in any studies locally?
So, the mainstay of certainly my research is the PINE study, and that's clearly closed to recruitment because we were recruiting new patients in a specified time period and then following them all up. There have been additional studies that have gone on around PINE, but at the moment we're not actually doing any of those additional studies. So the main studies involved that we're involved in at the moment are analysing the data that we already have, which is the biggest job we've got, and that takes quite a lot of resource. And then we are trying to be a centre for trials that are going on, that are being run by other major centres in the UK, and we're trying to provide a centre in Aberdeen to recruit patients to those. So the two trials that are going on at the moment, there's a trial called Top Hat, which actually we've struggled to recruit into because it's quite a tight inclusion criteria. So this is a study of a new treatment. So it's comparing a new treatment and placebo for hallucinations in people with Parkinson's disease, which hasn't responded to previous treatment for those hallucinations. So modifying their existing treatment or adding in some of the drugs that can help hallucinations. So if those fail, then they can be recruited into this study. It's quite a difficult trial to recruit into and you need to have specific criteria, but that is certainly, it's a worthwhile study. We're going to continue to try and recruit into that. So if there are other studies that come online, then we would certainly be involved we certainly try to be a centre in those. It's quite hard because we are a small unit and we have limited time, so we can't be doing everything because we literally just don't have the time to do that, particularly with our clinical workload.
And that's interesting, really, because for the Top Hat study, you need to have there's a clear and quite a strict eligibility criteria. So therefore, even though we've got a large population of people living with Parkinson's, not everybody is affected with hallucinations and therefore is not eligible to participate.
Correct. And actually, a lot of the patients who we have thought were eligible, the hallucinations settled on using one of the existing treatments. So they've actually, which is great because you want them to do that, but they've actually improved before we got them into the trial. So it is difficult, but that's the nature of research. You know, you have to have a specific question that you want answered, and not everybody is going to be eligible for that trial because they won't have the criteria to meet that specific question. Yeah.
And I suppose one of the other challenges up here is the northeast of Scotland is a huge geographical area going all the way up to Orkney and Shetland, which also makes it challenging recruiting people due to the demographics and the geography of this area.
Quite, absolutely. And one of the advantages again of COVID is that we've moved a bit more to remote, which has been which you can do research remotely, and we certainly have continued to see people in the PINE study remotely. It's not as good as seeing people face to face. The problem with these studies is that although they're trying to streamline the number of face to face visits, you still do need some face to face visits. So even if it's three visits, so Top Hat I think is three face to face visits over a 12-week period. I mean, to come down from Orkney or Shetland or the you know, some of the more rural parts of Aberdeenshire for that is actually, particularly if you've got quite significant Parkinson's disease, which people with hallucinations often will, is just beyond the bounds of their possibility. So even with the best of intentions, you know, it's difficult to get all people to come to take part in trials, because they're going to need face-to-face into some form of face-to-face assessment at some point in the trial.
So it might also be worth people looking at the Parkinson's UK Take Part Hub, where they can type in their postcode and it throws up research opportunities, you know, near them, or, you know, online or remote research opportunities which they could engage with. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, the only proviso to that I would perhaps add is and I don't do commercially sponsored research, mainly so that I can say I don't take pharmaceutical company money, so I haven't got a vested interest in any particular companies. One of the things I would say is that, so some of these sort of research sites, particularly some of the commercial research sites that are offering commercial studies, you need to have a good look about how valuable those studies are, because what we have to remember with pharmaceutical companies is what drives their agenda is, yes, they would like treatments that help people, but actually what they want are treatments that get licensed so that they can be prescribed and they can make profit. And that's a slightly different motivation to doing research than the sorts of studies that we get involved in, which are asking, you know, really important pragmatic questions and are sponsored and funded by non-commercial organisations and certainly not pharmaceutical companies. But that's an individual choice for every person.
No, it's absolutely a valid point to raise. Right, I'm very much going to put you on the spot here then, Carl. This is the golden ticket question, really. What would you say is the single biggest piece of research or breakthrough that we still need to make that will have make the biggest difference for people living with Parkinson's today?
So I think there are, again, probably two components to that. One is the blue sky forward-thinking approach that we definitely need treatments that delay nerve degeneration. I think it's ambitious to expect us to be able to stop nerve degeneration, certainly at the moment. It's also quite ambitious to think that we can reverse nerve degeneration, although that would obviously be the holy grail. But I think it's not unrealistic that we might find what we call neuroprotective treatments that delay or slow the progression of the condition, even on the symptomatic treatments that we've got at the moment. So that is clearly a major goal, and that's what, as I said, a lot of people are looking at. And it needs to be a treatment that's practical. Clearly there are very interventional treatments that people will be trying, but this, you know, you want something that's applicable to every person with Parkinson's. And so I think it's going to have to be an oral treatment. And so that's the aim of studies like the MAMS trial to try and generate those. But as I said, I think realistically it's going to be incremental. It's going to be little step, little step, little step, rather than suddenly waking up and finding, you know, we found something that makes a huge difference in terms of the speed of nerve loss in Parkinson's. And that's just because it's so complex. The other thing which I'm sort of fairly passionate about is I know it's, you talk about 15 years, but actually the here and now, we just need to improve the care that people with Parkinson's get in a holistic way. And that means and I'm not talking about medical care here, because as a neurologist, I have a list of drugs that I can use, and we do use them. They either, you know, most of them work very well. They have to obviously be monitored, but we've got those available. I'm talking about, we just need access to allow patients to live their lives to the full, empowering them to do that with their under their own steam, so giving them the resources to know where to go to get answers to help them solve their own problems, but it has to be done supported. So it has to be what I would regard as supported or guided self-management, and that will involve access to things like, you know, people with physio skills or exercise skills, OT skills, speech and language skills, need as the condition progresses. Proper care. So we undervalue care in this country enormously, and I think we need a real investment in care, because if you have got significant Parkinson's, actually a little getting access to care at the right time and at home. So, you know, for instance, supported respite care at home, not requiring to go into a different facility, which is you've never seen before and which will often cause people to get muddled or confused and they won't like. So trying to find those resources to deal with people at home, I think, and give them the support they need is really crucial. And that's not scientifically difficult to do. That just needs appropriate prioritisation of resources.
So really then the key priority is to invest in research funding to support how we can perhaps slow down the rate of decline of Parkinson's. And the other prong really is significant investment in a workforce that is there to support the here and now and to help people live a fulfilled life and skills and strategies they need to manage their Parkinson's.
Correct. Yeah.
So within that, I suppose then, do you think Parkinson's care will look any different in 15 years' time? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, That's a million dollar question. Yeah, and the honest answer is I really don't know. And I think I would like to think that we would have a medication or medications, a cocktail that we would be able to start people on as soon as they are diagnosed or showing potential signs that would slow the condition. It would be nice to think we might have some additional symptomatic treatments available, again, particularly, for some of the difficult non-motor features. But I just honestly don't know, because this is a tough nut to crack. I mean, this is a tough nut to crack. You know, there's a huge amount of resource, and that's gone up substantially, again, in my research career, just the amount of money that's being spent on Parkinson's research to try and answer those questions. And it's been difficult, and I think it probably will continue to be difficult. And certainly, and this is not necessarily what people want to hear, but what I would certainly caution against is being overly optimistic, because that raises expectations which I think are not necessarily always a good thing. You know, it can mean that people feel let down. I'll often say to people, if you wake up and the Sunday Express has a front page title saying we have cured Parkinson's, then don't believe it, because that is not medical research, and medical research into complex conditions that have defied the best minds around so far are not going to be solved overnight. I mean, that's just, I think, a logical statement. And it's certainly one that's based in history. If you look at the history of medical research, most degenerative conditions are not cured. And actually, we're very lucky in Parkinson's that we've got the treatments that we've got, because very many neurological conditions that have, degenerative neurological conditions would love to have the treatments that we have in Parkinson's. So I think we've got to be thankful for what we have and be realistic about what the future might hold. But that doesn't mean that we are nihilistic. You know, there will be advances. Yeah.
I think probably the one thing you've highlighted throughout this entire, podcast is really the fact that Parkinson's is so variable, and there has been some great breakthroughs. Our understanding of the pathology has moved on hugely in the last few decades. However, all that it perhaps has flagged up is how varied Parkinson's is, and how the pathophysiology is very diverse, and how complicated it is. And so really what we're looking at, it's not going to be one miracle pill that's perhaps going to result in a cure. It's what we're looking for. As you say, it's perhaps going to be a combination, or as you say, a cocktail of medications that are going to be required to manage people with Parkinson's. But at the same time, then we need those prognostic modelling, as you were saying right at the top of this conversation, so that we can think about what is going to be the right cocktail for certain people. And so there needs to be several streams of research coexisting, working in parallel, and really highlights the need for universities and clinical academics and those doing researches to work collaboratively collaboratively, so we're sharing that so we can pull that together, so we can start looking at optimized management based on research and really also clinical presentation, you know, the person sitting there in the chair, to make sure it's personalized to meet their needs.
And that is improving. So, in the last 20 years, the amount of collaboration that goes on between major research units is certainly increased. You know, we're involved in collaborative studies with people in Norway and Sweden and parts of the UK. As I said, this move to try and generate this new trial is involved a huge number of collaborators. So I think people have got the idea that you can't do this on your own. Absolutely. So I think that is a definite sign of progress. I mean, the one thing, again, I would say is that, I mean, although there's heterogeneity and you know, certain factors may play a role in some people more than another. So even if you look at the genetics in an individual, we know that there may be 60 or more genes that are involved in an individual's predisposition to Parkinson's. And that might vary slightly from individual to individual, but it's never going to be a single gene. It's going to be 60 plus. And therefore, they're all doing slightly different things. So to try, even in an individual who you think you can put into a certain group of how they're going to do over time, that's going to be complex to manage. So you're not going to identify one drug for one individual. It's going to be much more complex than that. But that's the challenge. I mean, as I said, I think it's important that people are realistic. I think it's important that people plan their lives realistically. I think, you know, the aim for every individual is to live life to the full, and that's what we would want them to do. And to some extent, you have to just do that. And regardless of what the future holds, just get on and live life. And that's certainly what I'm trying to do. and I hope, you know, and I'm sure that's what everyone with Parkinson's is trying to do as well.
I think that's a great positive note to end on. A huge thank you for your time this morning, Carl, to record this and for your insights into the sort of challenges, both positive in terms of exciting, it keeps us, there's good challenges to tackle, but also some of the challenges that places on actually delivering on research for the Parkinson's community. Thank you very much.
No, not at all. It's a pleasure. Thanks, Julie.